Denise Howell here. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. Tiffany Lee is our guest this week. Mike Keyes and Matt Curtis join me as well. Blurred lines are going to stay blurry as far as we can tell. Domino's and the Marlon Bundo Bunny have some trademark issues that we'll look at. Facebook might not be your friend, but we're going to, right here in March, give you our Christmas wish lists as to what we hope happens next in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica debacle. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 417, recorded March 23rd, 2018. Medium size it. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Law on today, March 23rd, 2018. We are thrilled to be here with you to discuss important developments in the news related to law and policy of the technology arena. It has not been a slow week. We were joking before the show that we would have nothing to talk about. We have much to talk about and a really fabulous panel of folks to do it. Joining us once again as a guest on TWiL is Tiffany Lee. Tiffany is an attorney and resident fellow at the Yale Information Society Project, and we are so glad to have you back. Tiffany, great to see you.
It's great to be back.
Tiffany has been doing a lot of writing and thinking this week about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, and we, in case you are wondering, are going to discuss a lot about that a bit later on in the show. Also joining us today are my two wonderful co-hosts. Mike Keyes is here. He is a partner at the Dorsey & Whitney firm in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Denise. Great to be with you.
Great to see you again. And Matt Curtis is with us as well. Matt is a law student at Notre Dame. Great to see you, Matt.
Great to be on again, and great to have Denise and Tiffany and Mike to discuss these interesting topics.
Yes. So as I said, we are definitely going to go deep as we can on Cambridge Analytica in a little bit later on in the show. But we have some entertainment and trademark related stories that are really fun too. And Mike has a hard out, so we're going to do those at the top of the show so that we can involve him in those discussions. And we're going to start in the trademark arena. All right, so one really fun story to kick off our show this week has to do with vice presidential bunnies and their publications. Vice President Mike Pence has a rabbit. Actually, it's not his rabbit. It's his daughter's rabbit. And its name is Marlon Bundo. And I'm hoping that a lot of our listeners and viewers have been following along with this story as it has unfolded over the week. But on last Sunday's episode of This Week Tonight with John Oliver, John Oliver concluded that the book that Marlon Bundo had published, the actual book, that the first book, the original book, that purports to have been written by the vice presidential pet, needed a companion volume. I haven't read the original book yet, but we were talking before the show. We presume it has to do with living where the Pences live and what it's like to be a pet of the vice president of the United States. But one thing, and this was almost our tip of the week this week, before we decided to make it one of our more substantively discussed stories. One thing the Pences did not do before they published this book, and by the way, all the proceeds for both of the books that we are going to discuss here today are going to charity. So that one thing they didn't do before deciding, hey, we're going to raise money in this nice way by publishing a vice presidential bunny book, is they did not trademark the bunny's name. And hence we have the rest of our discussion today, because John Oliver decided it would be quite fun to publish his own book purportedly authored by Marlon Bundo, the vice presidential Benny. And that book took on a quite different theme. Tiffany, can you tell us some more about this?
Sure. So the original book is about a bunny's life in the White House. And the new John Oliver book is about that same bunny, Marlon Bundo, but this time he's gay, falls in love, and ends up getting married. So slightly different plot line there.
Yes, and some pointed digs. I downloaded the audio version, the Audible book of John Oliver's. I'm not sure if that differs, if it's an abridged version of the hard copy, but it is a children's book that that has some wonderful voice talent involved in presenting the audio version of it. And it takes some digs at Vice President Pence, just by its subject matter, obviously, and also by at the very beginning when the bunny is sort of setting the stage for who he is and why he's telling his story. He says that his grandpa is Vice President Mike Pence and that the book isn't going to be about grandpa because grandpa's not very fun at all. So John Oliver clearly is taking trolling to a next level here. And over the week, Tiffany, what has happened with John Oliver's book?
Well, I think it's risen to maybe number one in the category, something like that. But it's a huge bestseller, very successful. Oh, there it is. And I think it's beating the other Marlon Bundo book, if I'm correct there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you took a look early on in the week at the legal issues around this. I mentioned that the Pences declined to trademark the vice presidential bunny's name, probably not something that anybody would have thought to do before our discussion here today and the events of this week. What is the import of that?
Well, it's interesting they didn't trademark the name. I mean, if they have, there could possibly be some legal claim for the Pences against John Oliver and Last Week Tonight. Now, this wouldn't be a very strong argument, but they could technically argue that John Oliver and Last Week Tonight infringed upon their trademark rights by using their trademark in the title of the book, in the book itself, and in the marketing materials surrounding the Last Week Tonight book. But they didn't, so they can't.
Your post talked a bit about a potential right of publicity claim. Of course, a bunny can't have a right of publicity claim, but a vice president might be able to, especially because he is mentioned in the book. What do you think about the chances of, well, first of all, of such a claim having any merit, and secondly, about such a claim actually being asserted?
So that claim doesn't really have much merit. I mean, Mike Pence is a public figure, and it would be very difficult to prove that they had violated on his right of publicity rights, or his, you know, privacy tort-related rights, like presenting him in a false light, or any of the legal issues surrounding, say, defamation. It's very difficult standard to prove when you have a public figure, and especially because this book is most likely going to be agreed upon to be a parody, right? It's pretty clear this is a parody, and it's pretty clear they're not actually saying anything intentionally negative or trying to prove something negative about Mike Pence. At least not something that's demonstrably false.
Let me kick this to our own Mike, Mike Keyes here, and see what you think about the trademark issues and other legal issues involved in this book, Mike.
So it's actually an interesting issue that the title of the book, the original, is Marlon Bundo's A Day in the Life of the Vice President. So typically, when it comes to registration of book titles, you can't get a trademark registration unless the title is part of a series. So I don't know, maybe there's multiple Marlon Bundo works of authorship out there, but they would have a hard time, I think, getting an actual registration on just the title. Now, if they were using the name for like collateral merchandise and some other things, they could potentially get a registration for Marlon Bundo when it comes to, for use on T-shirts or other types of of goods. But even without a registration, setting aside the registration issue, even if you don't have a registration, you can still enforce rights in an unregistered mark. But I agree with Tiffany that at the end of the day, this is a parody, and I think you would ultimately prevail on a parody defense here.
All right, Matt, do you have any thoughts about bennies and trademarks and dueling books?
Oh, so many, but I'll limit it to a few. First of all, if this was the president and not the vice president, we would have already seen the lawsuit in place and many tweets about this. So just a little different character that he's trolling. He should have went off to after the more responsible person in the White House. But second of all, in copyright law, so it's kind of an interesting analysis that if he wrote it as the vice president, under 18 U.S.C. 105, as a federal government employee, he wouldn't have been able to have a copyright on that. It's just probably done in the private sphere in some sense, and I'm not sure what the analysis is there. But is there a similar limitation on government works of trademark?
Not that I'm aware of, but you're right. There is the provision under the Copyright Act that says that works of the federal government created by federal government employees in the course and scope of their employment are not subject to copyright protection. So yeah, very, very good point.
Well, I think this book was written by Pence's daughter. I think either his daughter or his daughter in conjunction with some other family members. So it's not Pence himself actually sitting down and writing a book about the rabbit.
Yeah.
The Pence's actually handled this with some grace. I believe it was Karen Pence who tweeted two books for charity, win-win, something along those lines. So they did not express a lot of outrage or consternation about the fact that John Oliver had basically usurped their category for children's bunny books. That's a good thing.
Great response on their part. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. Hopefully that will be that, and that our legal discussions here are purely academic and sort of fun to think about, what must have gone through John Oliver's and his counsel's minds before they actually decided to unleash this book. At least I'm hoping some of these things crossed their minds. Any final thoughts, Mike, about Marlon Brando?
I guess the only other thing that could act as an impediment had the Pences wanted to try to register the name is the Trademark Office might have rejected an application for Marlon Brando, saying that it's too similar to Marlon Brando. That would be a potential basis under the Lanham Act. And I can't remember if Marlon Brando is still alive or not, but and I'm not sure if it matters for purposes of the Lanham Act anyway, but there is a prohibition about registering a name of somebody else, of a famous person, as I recall. So that could have been potentially another stumbling block for them.
Yeah. Stimby Cat in IRC is speculating on whether a Playboy Bunny book is in the work for other parts of the administration. I guess we'll just have to stay tuned for that. And I wanted to mention the cast of the audiobook, because they really do bring to life John Oliver's book in a pretty impressive way. Jim Parsons, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, Jeff Garlin, Ellie Kemper, John Lithgow, Jack McBrayer, and RuPaul. So something fun to do if you're looking to donate to the charities involved with either of these books. The audiobook is only $1.99, so kind of an interesting addition, sorry about that, to your Audible library. That is not our only interesting trademark discussion for the day, however. There is a YouTuber whose name is Sam Crack. Mm-hmm. He has told Jalopnik, who wrote this up, that his real name is Sam. He hasn't provided his real last name. But what he thought it would be interesting to do is to get his hands on a couple now of some Domino's branded Chevys that were equipped with pizza ovens in the back. These were made for and supplied to Domino's franchisees, and then apparently met some bad ends. Got totaled and wound up in the hands of insurance companies who sold them off. And this gentleman decided it would be really fun to own the Domino's branded cars and put them on YouTube and drive around with pizzas, I guess, because he's got a built-in oven. Domino's was not very happy about this. I think the really interesting part of this story is the fact that YouTube exists and that Sam decided to use it to feature the cars is really what triggered the legal dispute here. I think if Sam had just bought totaled Domino's cars and was driving them around, I don't think that the company would be coming after him. But because he chose to put them on YouTube and capitalize on the trademarks on the cars, that's what sort of triggered the parties to get sideways with each other. Sam received a trademark complaint from the YouTube site, although they left the video up, which I thought was interesting. So the notice was basically a warning, but not a warning that if you don't remove the trademark violation, we're going to take this down. And then began receiving, communicating directly with representatives of various pizza companies, multiple pizza franchisees, et cetera, to try to get Sam from using the trademarks on his cars. They basically asked him to turn it back into a regular Chevy. They also didn't want him to continue to feature their proprietary hardware, the pizza oven in the back. They wanted that removed. So, Mike, do you think Sam is okay to drive around in his Domino's cars and continue to feature them on YouTube?
Well, it's a great trademark question in a couple of different respects. I couldn't tell from the articles that I read whether he's actually doing anything of a commercial nature or mm-hmm. if he's just kind of driving about town in his Domino's vehicle. Setting aside, I'm just assuming for purposes of my analysis and my take on it, I'm assuming that he's not doing anything commercial. You know, he's not selling products out of his vehicle or otherwise using this in some sort of commercial endeavor.
Well, before you go too far with that assumption, he's okay. making money on YouTube.
Well, that's true, but is he making money in the commercial sense that he's providing a service or selling a good with the other company's trademarks? I think he's just making money by virtue of the fact that he's a YouTuber, right?
Right. Uh-huh.
So he's not selling a product per se, or providing a service in a confusingly similar way. He's providing commentary and I guess ultimately making money as a result of his YouTube comments, but he's not using this in a traditional trademark sense from my, mm-hmm. at least as near as I can tell. So right. given that, if you're not using somebody else's trademark in commerce, in some sort of commercial transaction, then you can say, look, the Lanham Act's not even triggered here. I have a First Amendment right to drive around in a car in any way I want. And so long as I'm not engaging in some sort of commercial activity, you can't do anything to stop me. So that would be one argument that would be pretty strong, as near as I can tell. But the other argument is what we call trademark exhaustion. So I'm not sure what the original origin of this car was. Was it owned by a franchisee initially, and was it authorized by Domino's at some point along the way? If it was, then Sam Crack could say, look, you you initially authorized for this vehicle to be made, once you have put it into the stream of commerce or authorized for it to be put into the stream of commerce, you can't control downstream sales of it. So you can't stop me from using or repairing the car that I initially and lawfully purchased from a third party. So that would be another argument that I think he has at his disposal potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's the two thoughts I had.
It's a really interesting case. Tiffany, do you have any thoughts?
Sure. I think that the distinction that Mike just made about the YouTube use versus the possible use in actually, say, delivering pizzas, that's very important. Mm-hmm. If it's just the issue of whether or not he can display the car within a YouTube video, I think he's clearly within his rights. If nothing else, there is a pretty strong fair use defense here, right? He can say that he was just making commentary or even making a parody of the use of Domino's cars, for example. So I think the YouTube video itself is probably okay. If he were to actually go around town driving in this car and for some reason trying to sell pizzas out of the back of it, that would obviously be another problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think at minimum what he has done is point out to Domino's that if they don't want people doing what he's doing or, you know, reusing the cars that were given to their franchisees, they're going to have to exercise some greater corporate control over what happens to these things after they wreck. So I'm assuming they're going to take some further steps because they don't seem to like what's going on here. Matt, do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, I just think it's an interesting strategy to handle this situation. It seems like someone driving around in a car that has my advertising on it, as long as they're, you know, being reasonable about it, and it seems like, you know, his YouTube videos were restoring the car. That seems like a great thing rather than having negative press about, you know, the questions of handling, you know, some guy who put in a bunch of work on a car that you had sold. That just seems like a poor brand strategy to try to maximize the benefit. But that's about it.
Mike, what if you were running around doing objectionable things in this branded car that Domino's does not want associated with their brand?
Well, by objectionable, are these commercial in nature or are you just out like saying and doing things that other people could find offensive?
Yeah,
I'm more thinking of that. I don't see that being a Lanham Act problem. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as, you know, I'm a big in favor of brands protecting their images and their IP, there are some outer bounds with respect to that issue. And if you have a automobile that's decked out in Domino's trade dress and you're driving around town and, you know, saying all sorts of things that people may find offensive, if there's no commercial aspect to it, then it's not a Lanham Act problem. So, but I think Matt's exactly right. You know, brands deploy various strategies for dealing with things like this. I always like to think about the example of Coca-Cola. When Facebook first came out, there was a Coca-Cola page that was set up by a couple of fans of the brand. And they had millions of followers. And, you know, what Coke did is instead of kind of going after them and telling them to shut down the page, they actually partnered with these guys and took them down to the headquarters in Atlanta, you know, gave them a tour of the Coke Museum and used it as an opportunity to really engage with consumers. I thought it was a brilliant strategy. This other Domino's has kind of gone in a different direction, so to each his own. But it does raise interesting issues and questions as to how you go about enforcing and protecting your brand in these various contexts.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting. They're very different stories, the Marlon Brando one and this one, but both of them involve a repurposing of right. somebody's brand in ways that were not anticipated and that might be surprising and perhaps not in keeping with the goals of the original person. So,
right.
All right. There was a big decision from the Ninth Circuit. Was it just yesterday or the day before, Mike, in the Blurred Lines case?
Yeah, a couple of days ago.
So let's talk about that next in the realm of Hollywood music and entertainment. Regular listeners to the show and longtime listeners to the show might remember that we have discussed the case brought by the estate of Marvin Gaye against, I almost said Alan Thicke, Robin Thicke, concerning his Blurred Lines song. The crux of this case and the reason we found it so interesting to discuss is it's one of these many cases where a song is alleged to be a copyright violation because it sounds like another song. But this one is quite a stretch to make that argument because it's very difficult to identify particular passages of these songs that are at all identical. What they are is sort of similar in feel. There's a style to the song that when you hear it, you go, oh yeah, you know, that does kind of sound like that Marvin Gaye song. But it's not what we think of as a traditional kind of copyright infringement situation. So it's been a case that's been interesting to watch. The Marvin Gaye estate won at trial and on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit took a very hands-off approach and decided not to weigh in, not to go too deep into the weeds of appellate procedure. But one of the things that counts a lot on appeal is what standard of review the court decides to apply under the various standards that can apply. The court can be very proactive and look at everything anew. That's called de novo review, and make a whole new decision if it wants. Or it can give great deference to the trial court, and it tends to do that in areas that are heavily factual, where the jury has been given facts to determine and has made those determinations, and they seem to have applied the law correctly. That's when the appellate court can get involved if there's been any error of the law. Here, the court decided that its role was to review whether the law had been applied correctly, and it decided that it had, and it left all the findings of the jury intact and basically left the verdict intact, and the estate of Marvin Gaye wins this one as far as the Court of Appeal is concerned. Tell us more about it, Mike.
No, that's a great summary of exactly what happened. I think many of us that were waiting for this decision thought it might be a nice opportunity for the Ninth Circuit to talk about and get into the weeds when it comes to music copyright protection and infringement, because there were some pretty good arguments by the defendants that, look, Even though we admitted that we were inspired by Marvin Gaye, really all the similarities here relate to unprotectable elements. We wanted to have this funky sounding song that we created. So in that respect, it's got a similar groove or a similar type of style. But other than that, you can't really say that these two songs are substantially similar. So I think they made some very compelling arguments to the Ninth Circuit. And we were I know I personally was hoping that the Ninth Circuit would take a deep dive and deal with those arguments, because I think there was an opportunity here to really clarify what the scope of protection is for a piece of music. But as you said, Denise, what the court said is, look, we're taking a very hands-off approach here. You know, music means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Lots of different elements come together to form a musical work. And who are we to say that there was an infringement here, is essentially what the Ninth Circuit said, or at least this panel. Now, we should point out, though, that this was not a majority decision. It was a 2-1 decision by a panel of the Ninth Circuit. And the dissenting judge... wow. I mean, if you're looking for an opinion of a dissenting judge that really takes the majority to task, the dissenting opinion by Judge Nguyen is really a first rate. I mean, she puts on a masterclass here in terms of judicial decision making. And what she does is she goes right through each and every one of these elements and explains why the alleged similarities here, why each of these individual elements are not protectable. And I thought she puts together a very compelling argument in support of her dissenting opinion. So this is a 2-1 decision. There's really two things left for the defendants to do here. They could ask for rehearing en banc, which is essentially asking for the entire Ninth Circuit to weigh in on the case. And typically that is a very tough road to hoe because most appellate courts don't reconsider a case en banc. It happens from time to time. We've talked many times about the Simon Tam, the Slants case. There was a rehearing en banc by the Federal Circuit in that case, but it is by far and away the exception, not the rule. So there is the possibility for them to essentially take Judge Nguyen's dissent and say the full Ninth Circuit needs to reconsider this issue because it's so important when it comes to music copyright. And then, of course, the other avenue here is to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in and make a determination as to whether these specific elements are subject to copyright protection. So interesting case. I'm hopeful that the Ninth Circuit will rehear it or the Supreme Court will take it because it shouldn't be the end of the line here. I think this area of law really needs to be cleaned up and further developed.
Yeah, I love Judge Nguyen's point that if this is how we're going to leave the state of the law in this area, that perhaps the estate of Marvin Gaye will wish that they hadn't gone down this road because various of Marvin Gaye's musical compositions could be found to be infringing of other people's works under this standard, which yep. I thought was kind of an interesting point to make. But the other two judges did not find that they were particularly disturbed by that prospect. Probably the estate of Marvin Gaye was surprised to read that when they read it in the dissent. But I think it's a really interesting case. I think it would be really fun if the U.S. Supreme Court were to take this up and they were to listen to cowbells and party noises and stuff in open court, although that was one of the issues that was challenged on appeal, that the jury was not actually allowed to hear the sound recording at trial.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Which seems like something that the appellate court here could have weighed in on and said, yeah, that was prejudicial and error.
I agree with you. I mean, it is an issue not only in the Blurred Lines case, but this exact same issue is being considered by the Ninth Circuit in the Stairway to Heaven case as well. The question is whether the jury should have been allowed to hear a comparison of the two sound recordings or whether it was limited to just hearing the sheet music on the Marvin Gaye song. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of an interesting wrinkle there. I think Marvin Gaye's family was arguing that, look, you know, everything, you shouldn't do anything with the decision here. You should affirm it. But to the extent you're going to reverse it, you should deal with this issue of whether it was proper for the jury to just be instructed with respect to the sheet music or whether they should have been allowed to hear the audio recording of the Marvin Gaye original. But, you know, ultimately, the court affirmed it and didn't need to get to that issue. And it said in the opinion, we assume, you know, without deciding the issue, that the trial court got it right and instructed the jury and only allowed the evidence in that the jury should have considered.
Matt, anything you want to add here?
Yeah, just a quick question is, so when they're doing this analysis of the case, are they doing an elements approach where they're saying that they had – so Mike talked about, you know, the musical elements are not necessarily copyrighted. So in the decision that the jury has put forward to them, are they presenting this as a single question or as a series of questions?
You know, Matt, I don't recall if there was like a special verdict form where they were asked to consider each individual constituent elements of the song. I don't think that happened. That would seem odd to me. I think they would just be asked, do you find that the two pieces are substantially similar? Yes or no?
Yeah. Just to compare that with like criminal law. So in the criminal law with the elements, you have to go through each element, and that would make it easier for an appellate review to be able to look at it. Because if you're just asking the question, is it substantially similar, and every appellate court is going to review that means that your decision that the jury made it's you know, you're looking at a black box of sort of why that was decided, and you're leaving it up to them. So you're not breaking out the elements into different forms of analysis. Where if they were broken out, you could, you know, it's a one-dimensional question of whether each of these elements was met. So it does just make it harder for the appellate court, because either they have to jump in full force or they have to jump in not at all. So I think that's why, you know, there's such a big difference between, or it could be why there's such a big difference in the two opinions.
Yeah, that's a really good point,
that's
Matt.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess word to the wise attorneys in these kinds of cases, if you're worried about it going your way, a special verdict form could be your friend. Tiffany, any thoughts?
I think that, I mean, I personally was a little disappointed in this opinion or this decision, not just because they ignored some of the crucial elements and not just because the jury instructions were a little questionable, but I think that just generally this is pretty bad precedent if it gets to that point. If we make this the standard for music copyright infringement, basically we can't have any new music because every type of new music is inspired by other music. Much of new music now includes elements or slightly similar tones from music that's come before. So this is problematic. Hopefully it'll go to appeal. We'll see what happens then.
Yeah, I think the whole realm of EDM is cringing to the extent it's even aware of this decision, just because of what you say, you know, that elements are layered on other elements and you're trying to echo a sound quite frequently and make people think of something they've listened to before. All right, let's move on to development in the realm of artificial intelligence and robotics. Well, as everyone's aware, self-driving cars are being tested in various places in the country, including Arizona. And we had last Sunday, sadly, the first episode of a self-driving Uber car. There was a human in the car, but the car was in auto driving mode at the time when this happened. Killed a pedestrian in Arizona. And I believe this is the first incident we've had of a self-driving car killing a pedestrian. And the upshot of the investigation that has proceeded in the wake of the accident, which was last Sunday, is the chief of police in Tempe has concluded that Uber is not likely responsible for the crash that killed a 49-year-old pedestrian named Elaine Hertzberg. Elaine was pushing her bicycle on a median next to the road. The bicycle was loaded down with plastic shopping bags, and she quickly veered from the center median into a lane of traffic. And the police chief doesn't, you know, expresses concern or skepticism that any car could have avoided her when they reviewed the video and saw the way in which she entered the traffic lane and considered the lighting. It was dark at the time, et cetera. So probably, according to the police chief there, and I'm sure various investigations are still unfolding, including NTSB investigations, Uber may not be legally at fault with this one. And so although it's you know, bad PR for self-driving Uber cars and self-driving cars in general, apparently this one may have been pedestrian caused rather than car caused. Any thoughts, Tiffany?
I think it's interesting that law enforcement made this determination so quickly that Uber wasn't at fault. I mean, obviously they have a cynical view of this would be that they have their reasons, right? That the state of Arizona decided to allow self-driving cars on the road, which has encouraged companies like Uber to test their fairly untested technology on the roads in Arizona, right? So if something then happens and it's the fault of those new cars, that could have potential political consequences. I also think, though, that it's a little questionable because, sure, a human driver maybe would not have seen that pedestrian. It's hard to see things in the dark, right? We don't have night vision as human beings. But the issue is that the LiDAR systems that these self-driving cars use, they actually do have night vision. The entire point is that they can see better than humans. They can sense further. They can tell where objects are at a better, a more efficient rate than human beings can. So this failure doesn't really strike me as something that, oh, just would have happened if the person was driving. This is a sort of harm that self-driving cars was supposed to prevent, but it really doesn't seem to have done so in this case.
Yeah, I'm glad that, you know, both Uber and the NTSB, and I'm sure various state regulatory agencies will look into this further, because, I mean, we, as you say, we have the opinion of the police chief as to who was culpable here, having reviewed some video, and various factors are going to come into play here. It could be that they wind up concluding that the car actually handled the situation better than a human driver could have. It could be that this is just an instance of, you know, a reckless or careless behavior on the part of the pedestrian that would have been deadly in any situation. And that maybe, as you point out, you know, with the enhanced abilities of these cars, that it handled it as well as could be expected. Or we may, on the other end of the spectrum, decide that, yeah, a human might have given the woman wider berth or taken a step that this car did not in this situation. So it's so early days with these things. It's a little bit terrifying to think that the way that they're being tested is just to go out on the road and see what they hit and whether they have a better record when it comes to safety than all of the rest of us plowing around in our cars. But that is the hope, I guess. Any thoughts, Mike?
Yeah. More in the form of a question. From the accounts I read, wasn't there a safety driver involved? I mean, somebody was behind the wheel of this thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so the rush to judgment or the rush to clear Uber, it seemed, well, that kind of complicates it a little bit further, I would think, in that, I mean, I assume the purpose of having a safety driver there is to make sure that you've got a human that's ready to intercede in the event that, the technology doesn't do its job. So, you know, what was that person doing? Were they paying attention to what was going on? Should they have noticed the poor person that was ultimately killed? I mean, so it seems like there's a lot of complicating factors that need to be resolved here.
Yeah, let's hope he or she was not just tuning out to Netflix while the car was in auto mode.
Right.
Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, a couple things. The first is that it probably, you know, whether the intentions of the sheriff was good or some political motive, like it probably wasn't a good idea for him to weigh in on the legal implications of this, because, you know, if you look at Uber, what Uber did, I think they did the right thing and they said, hey, we're really sorry for this woman and, you know, we're going to shut down everything and we're going to make sure that we're doing everything correctly. And that was, you know, probably the correct response. Obviously, you know, we're all really sorry for this woman as well. This is nothing to celebrate, or you know, this is a big day for autonomous driving. The second thing is that, like, when we think about the standards of negligence, and I'm not familiar with Arizona's law, but this is sort of like the blurred lines thing in that negligence is determined at the jury level. And so what's going to be put in front of a fact pattern for these jurors is that, was it negligent or was it not? And one thing that we'll see over the next couple of years is sort of what the discussion was coming about is, what is the standard of negligence? Is it an ordinary human or an ordinary human driver, or is it a whatever the technology is? So it'll be a really interesting legal question, which will reach the appellate level of what is the standard of negligence, and it'll be in all 50 different states. And you know, this is something we'll be tracking, I'm sure, for years to come as the law develops here. An interesting way to look at that is that when horses were the way of transportation, negligence was not the same for a car. It was typically higher for the car early on. There was all kind of crazy laws about just not having cars too, because they were loud and noisy and boisterous and tended to hit things at higher speeds. So that's just something that we'll have to watch and see how it develops. So I don't think there's a really clear, you can say it's negligence or not, when we don't even know what the standard of negligence is going to be. So
Those are really good points, as is your assumption in making them all, that this is going to wind up in court before a jury at some point. And there are various avenues for it to get there, whether the heirs of the woman who was killed decide to sue Uber, whether some regulatory body decides or law enforcement body decides that there's some reason and basis under state or federal law to bring a court action on this. But I think it's a good guess that it will wind up in court, but it's not something that I had necessarily jumped to right away. I sort of had considered that, you know, in this wide open Wild West world of testing self-driving cars, that maybe some sort of regulatory proceeding might be the way that this goes. But you're right, at some juncture, whether it's this case or some other one, a jury is going to be asked to determine whether one of these companies was negligent. And it will be interesting to see how they deal with those issues. What do you think about that, Tiffany?
I think it's interesting. I think I first would like to ask, did any of you watch the actual video of what happened? I mean, it's a little mm-hmm. disturbing. So it's the video taken from the dash cam that shows exactly what the person in the car was seeing, and also shows the reaction of the human safety driver after the accident.
Oh.
But it does show that the human safety driver was not watching the road. That person was looking down, probably at a cell phone, when it happened.
Oh, dear.
Right. Yeah. So there's that issue.
Yeah, so there's...
Oh, there we go. Oh yeah.
There's good.
So if you're watching our video, it's rolling right now, and oh yeah, he's very much taken by surprise, and not really watching the road at the time.
There's good statistics that an individual who is not fully engaged in driving a car is actually more of a liability to be in the car driving it, because the reaction time is that sort of I'm jumping and whoa, this happened quickly, because your ability to pay attention to something that you're not actively paying attention to is just much lower. And so you tend to overcorrect and over respond when that happens. Yeah, I always think it's a sort of a strange strategy to have these people in the car when, think about riding in the car for 5 hours and not driving, and how realistically I couldn't stay focused for 12 hours. I don't care how much they're paying me. There's just no way.
I mean, that's what truck drivers do, though, right?
Yeah, well, except for they're driving the car the whole time. They're actively touching
the
wheel.
That's more engaging.
Yeah, so there's a response feedback loop that you're getting internally, and if you're just jumping in, you're not connected with the response internal loop. But yeah, I mean, yeah. I would assume that truck drivers, go through some of the same stuff, and that they're going down the road straight, but they still have their hands on the wheel. They're still even if you're not totally engaged, you're engaged at some level where you don't have to be, and so you tend to grab the wheel and move quickly. So. And there's good statistics that shows that it's just not it's better to not have someone in the car than to have somebody who can intervene in a sudden jolt.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, for in the truck driver scenario, their personal safety is on the line and is completely or largely in their own hands, right? If they're not paying attention, they're putting themselves at risk. So they have a strong self-interest in making sure that they are doing what they need to do. But when you're a safety driver for a self-driving car in auto mode, you have delegated some of those tasks at any rate to the car as the primary responsible agent, and you're just there for oversight. And you might not feel that oversight requires that minute attention that driving actually does. So, sad story. All right, Mike, we hate to leave you on, have you leave us on that depressing note, but I know you've got to run.
Yeah. I do. Sorry, I have to cut it short today, but great to be with all of you, and we'll see you next time.
All right, great seeing you, Mike.
Great seeing you, Mike.
Thanks. Take care, all.
All right. Let's see. I was going to try and put together an MCLE passphrase from our earlier discussions here before we move on to the next part of the show. Matt, do you have a suggestion?
Something around like blurred lines are still blurred.
All right. I like it.
All right.
Blurred lines still blurred will be our first passphrase for MCLE purposes for listening to this episode of This Week in Law. If you are a lawyer or other professional, you might enjoy watching or listening to our show to meet your professional education credits. If you're a lawyer, if you head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there. We've got a chart of the 50 United States and whether that might work for you in your jurisdiction or not. Just trying to give you a little help there. We'll put another passphrase in later on in the show. Some jurisdictions, we hope that this is helpful to you to have you demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. Blurred lines, still blurred. All right, with that, we are going to move on to our privacy discussion. So by now, folks watching and listening are probably familiar with the fact that Facebook has had an interesting week, as have 50 million of its users who found that their information was being used in ways that they did not anticipate by a company called Cambridge Analytica, the ins and outs of this story are pretty labyrinthine as to the way in which an app was used to harvest this data. And we can get into those details in a moment. But the bigger picture here is that I'd kind of like to take this in chronological order if we could, starting back in about 2010 and coming up to our present debacle and what it means. But between 2010 and 2014, 2015, the way that Facebook was architected to permit access to user data by third-party apps was different than the way it is now. And it allowed for the collection of data that people probably did not realize was happening. Facebook had a consent decree with the FTC in 2011 that was partially designed around this. The FTC was not happy with how this was proceeding and put some restrictions on Facebook. It's far from Facebook is what we've been seeing this week. Facebook, through that consent decree, for example, was barred from making representations about the privacy or security of a consumer's personal information. It was required to obtain a consumer's affirmative express consent before overriding privacy preferences, and it was required to prevent anyone from accessing a user's material more than 30 days after the user had deleted his or her account. So the FTC was concerned way back early in this decade with the way that Facebook was handling data, and Facebook assured the FTC that it would take steps to remedy these situations. In the meantime, the way its apps were operating was still providing a whole lot of information that its users were unaware or probably just not paying attention because of the way Facebook is architected and the way it discloses what information is being shared. In any event, it made a change in 2014 and moving into 2015 that changed the landscape. And I think that it's really there that this whole incident comes to a head, because at that point, Facebook realized that this Cambridge Analytica data was out there, was being handled in a way that was against its policies. And then, unfortunately, the other shoe never dropped. Facebook did not follow through on making sure that the data was destroyed or deleted or otherwise handled in a way that would have matched up with its users' expectations. And then we fast forward to the New York Times story that broke last Friday and Facebook's suspension of Cambridge Analytica and the fallout this week. So, Tiffany, you've written about this for Slate. Can you give us some of the details, first of all, of how this came to pass, aside from Facebook architecture issues, and your take on the legal ramifications?
It's a very complicated situation. Mm-hmm. So obviously, the reason why this happened is because there were maybe some issues with the way Facebook decided to open its API to third-party app developers. Right, so that's the architecture problem. Maybe they didn't build in privacy by design. They didn't think of privacy in their product development lifecycle. That's an issue, and that's always been an issue. But I think the controversy happened because Facebook didn't say anything or do anything about this problem, and they didn't react until they had news that the breaking news would suddenly expose them. So The Guardian and The New York Times both were working on similar stories, and both had apparently contacted Facebook before the exposés were published. This is probably why Facebook released that Friday evening sudden announcement. That's the sort of backstory about how all of this went down.
Mm-hmm. So what I keep coming back to in this whole debacle, first of all, I do want to get into your Slate piece about assigning blame in a moment. But some of the blame, I think, has to fall on Facebook because of what it knew, when it knew it, and then what it didn't do. It knew about the breach in 2015. It demanded that Cambridge Analytica destroy the data. The firm said it did that. Should that have been enough? Should Facebook have had some sort of follow-up or compliance or... could there have been a lawsuit filed if they decided that the data was not being handled correctly and that Cambridge Analytica was in breach of its policies and guidelines?
Sure. There are many things Facebook could have done. At the very least, Facebook could have suspended Cambridge Analytica and or blocked them entirely. Right. That's the very least they could do, not even thinking of legal solutions. On a legal level, they could have, for example, they could have informed users about what happened. They could have followed up. They could have sent a C&D to Cambridge Analytica against using the data. There are various ways that Facebook could have taken more responsibility and more quickly. I think, of course, the issue is, though, if they had come out with this story, let's say 2 or 3 years ago, and had shut off Cambridge Analytica and made all this public, that would have been a big scandal. Of course, because they didn't do that, they were so afraid of that scandal that they've now become part of this much larger problem. And this much larger problem even takes into account things like possible election interference or national security issues. So yes, they should have acted earlier, and they are definitely at least partially to blame.
Okay, but how about all of us? Are we culpable as well?
I wrote that in my Slate article, and this is probably the point that most people did not love in my article. I got a lot of feedback about this. I mean, no one likes to hear that they are to blame, especially for something that happened without their knowledge. And here you can say that, you know, it wasn't really fair to say users could have done something because we had no idea what was happening. The average user was probably not aware that their data was being harvested by these apps, and we certainly weren't aware of the extent to which firms like Cambridge Analytica were using our data to build these incredibly tailored advertising profiles and then to use those profiles as part of political campaigns. Most people were not aware of any of those things. So on one hand, you could say, sure, people shouldn't be to blame. What I argued, though, is that we should at least take a little bit of responsibility. I think that collectively, all of us have decided that we are willing to trade off some of our privacy in exchange for new tech, new services. We like the Fitbit so we can track how many steps we walk. So we wear it every day, and it's collecting all of our location data all the time. We like the convenience of not having to physically turn on or off our lights at home. So we connect Philips Hue light bulbs to Amazon Echoes, right? Like, we've all decided that this is an okay trade-off. Basically, what this means is we've all created this monster, really, this new world where you don't have data privacy and where your privacy is almost impossible to protect. Regardless of whatever Facebook did or didn't do, part of that blame should probably also fall on us.
Is there an assumption, though, in those situations, whether we're talking about what you're posting to Facebook or how you're turning your lights on, that you're sharing your data with one company? And of course, whether you've decided to read that company's privacy policies is probably an academic and comedic question, because nobody actually does that. But you may have decided, I trust this company. They're large, they're accountable, they may be publicly traded or not, but I feel that, you know, it's in the company's interest sufficiently to look after my data, that I can trust them. Is that, you know, an assumption that people are warranted in making?
That's an interesting question. And I would point to this very academic article that one of the professors at Yale Law School wrote, I think about 6 months to a year or two ago. It's Professor mm-hmm. Jack Balkin, and he's the founder of the Information Society Project, which is where I do my legal research. Mm-hmm. Professor's Balkin article argued that we should consider these tech platforms like Facebook as a sort of information fiduciary. So similar to how you would consider, you know, a financial fiduciary, he says that these tech platforms have such a strong trust relationship with users that they need to have special responsibilities. So that's basically, I think, what you were just getting to, right? Mm-hmm. That people trust Facebook and we assume that they're taking care of our data, but nothing in the law says they have to, really. I mean, aside from the very bare minimums that U.S. privacy law asks for them to do. We don't have that special relationship codified in the law.
Right. And there's another piece by an academic I think is interesting for this. This is by Jonathan Albright, who's a professor and a researcher in news journalism and hashtags. And what he points out is that Facebook is not necessarily living up to that fiduciary responsibility that people assume that it might have over their data because of the way that it's built its interface. And I would argue because of the way that its priorities are lined up. And I'll talk about that in a second. But as far as the interface goes, he writes, Facebook's interface has been built around the false pretenses of giving users control over what is shared, but the focus is on posting or outward sharing, what we actively choose to share. In reality, Facebook users have the exact opposite ability to control what is passively shared about them, meaning the information and metadata that others can extract. In this sense, Facebook's privacy settings are a grand illusion. Control over post sharing, the people we share to, should really be called publicity settings. likewise control over passive sharing, the information people can take from us, the information people, that's how that reads, should be called privacy settings. So he argues that there should be this distinction, and I'm assuming he's meaning that regulators should insist that Facebook specify the distinction between your publicity settings or what you're putting out on your page and what can be gleaned about you just from your activity on the site and various other aspects of your profile. What do you think about that, Tiffany?
I'm not sure that really tracks with current privacy law. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, this professor or researcher has looked into this very deeply, but current privacy laws do enforce certain obligations for all types of data collection. So not just data that is posted by users, but also data collected sort of in a more hidden manner. So privacy laws say that your policies, for example, have to note every point of data collection. And this includes data outside of user-generated content. This includes location data, browsing data, and so on. So I think the current regulations, the laws and regulations, do take care of this. Mm-hmm. The larger issue probably is that the entire ecosystem is based on data, especially data that you are not consciously adding, right? That's the entire business model of Facebook and pretty much the entire internet at this point. The internet runs on advertising and it runs on user data. So that's the key problem. And I'm not sure we can fix that just by, for example, saying that Facebook has to pay the FTC another fine.
Right. And that's where I'm totally in agreement with you that this problem is the reason we're discussing this right now, the reason that Facebook is facing this huge PR debacle over this, is because their priorities are oriented to please their actual clients, their advertisers, and not the people who think that they are Facebook's clients, the users. And so decisions get made that sacrifice the interests of the users for the advertisers. It's a lot like money in politics. That you think that your elected representative is representing your interests in Washington, but you need to take into account who is contributing to that person's campaign and how beholden they are to that person and in what way. And I think we've got this dichotomy playing itself out in the social networking arena, in the search arena, perhaps in a different way. Wherever advertising is the financial basis of how these companies are supported. And I think what we're going to see one way or another is the FTC and other lawmakers starting to focus in on that conflict of interest and perhaps start to force these companies to put users' interests first and force them to figure out a way to appease the advertisers anyway. Matt, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, so I think this is like an incredibly, incredibly complicated situation. The Cambridge Analytic has its own backstory. I think that the point that Denise made earlier, which was, you know, how could they have followed up and made sure that the data was actually deleted, like, seems like an eminently reasonable thing that, like, if you have a company and you have a data breach or not a data breach, whatever this was, that someone has data that they shouldn't be having, whether you gave it to them and they're continuing to use it, but like to make sure you're running your protocol when they tell you they've deleted that information, that you delete that information. On a larger scale, though, like, to me, it doesn't matter whether Cambridge Analytica was selling data to the Trump campaign or whether it was Facebook. Like, the question is like, in the real issue here, at least from a PR relationship, is like, you know, there's at least a narrative, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not, that a large part of how Donald Trump got elected was really good targeted advertising. I query that. I don't know whether that's true. I don't have any data on that. That seems to be the response. Following the logical implications of that, of whether we want to limit political campaigns from using targeted advertising, which is sort of like how the regulation would have to take form. So you can't use specific data from Facebook or from someone else for political advertising. I think that runs right into the First Amendment. I don't see how we can say that for, you know, selling you a book or selling you, you know, whatever, you can see the data that's being used, and we can't use that for politics. I think it's hard, and I think that's politics, and so I don't know, and it's going to be an interesting thing to come down.
I want to get into before we wrap up this topic. I want to get into what happens next and what, you know, what our gut reactions are as to what happens to Facebook, what happens to the users, what do government entities do in response to this. But before we do that, Dwayne Knight asks a really interesting question in chat, and that going to this issue of, could Facebook have done anything differently? Should it have done anything differently once it realized years ago that this was a problem? Is proving deletion possible, he asks. And I think forensically that it might be. You know, if you realize all of the servers where the data is residing, and all of the individuals with access to those servers, and you track down, you know, every single interaction, transfer, et cetera, I mean, it would be a big pain, but I would assume you would be able to have some assurance that someone had not squirreled this away on a thumb drive and walked out with it. I don't know, but I'm sure there are computer forensics people out there who would want to take a stab at making sure that deletion was possible. And if there were, you know, areas of weakness, like what I just described, they would at least be able to point that out and say, we haven't been able to control for this. Do you agree, Tiffany?
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Deletion is pretty difficult to prove. And I think you're right. There are a lot of computer forensic scientists who would be able to, you know, track the data flow. But there are also a lot of ways to sort of prevent certain types of data transfer from showing up. And there are even ways to get data that, you know, we don't really think about as much, or that haven't really been talked about in the law. So we think of, this is not really something that's relevant right now, but this might be more relevant in the future. But the issue of quantum computing will definitely change the way we think about data deletion and whether that's possible. But I do think that you can say that Facebook should have done more, but I'm not sure you can say that Facebook had a responsibility to find out where the data went. Because even if that is possible, that is a huge burden. And that's not really something that's necessary under the law right now.
Yeah. Matt, can I jump in real quick?
Yeah.
Yeah, just that. So they wouldn't necessarily have to see whether they had deleted the information. They would just have to see whether they're basically offering analytics on this data set. So they knew the 250,000 people who the data was about. And all they would have had to see is, like, when you're going out to sell this to other customers, are you saying that you have this data set? And it seems like they were kind of saying that. So like, that would have been an easy way to follow it. But, like, again, like, I just mean from a corporate, like, sort of a brand management strategy, like having a second protocol that when someone has stolen something from you and then tells you that they've done something, you know, to correct this, the theft that they had earlier, it seems logical to not believe them. but from a public policy perspective, like, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't cure up all the issues and all of that. It just seems like, when someone lies to you, you probably want to check into what they're saying next time.
Okay, let's gaze into our crystal balls here and decide whether any of what has happened this week makes a difference. And if so, what we can expect to see happen in response. What do you think, Tiffany?
I think that there are some potential good things that could happen, but there are also some very potentially negative changes that we might see occur. I think generally we see a shift in how we're thinking about privacy, which I think is good. I think it's good that consumers are more aware of what's happening with their data. And I also think it's generally speaking a good thing that policymakers are taking this into account as well. What I'm afraid of, though, is that this might be an opportunity for some people to put into place regulations that might not be formulated to actually address the real problems. So I think there's been a push from a lot of policymakers in the US and around the world, really, to sort of take to task these platforms. And some of this is because people are looking for someone to blame for some of the issues with fake news and so on. So I would worry that this could be another opportunity for people to create legislation that doesn't actually address the problems, but just happens to be able to scapegoat Mark Zuckerberg, for example. Mm-hmm. And there, we have to remember there are good things about Facebook. There are good things about Twitter. There are reasons why we have social media networks. We've seen, for example, we've seen protesters around the world use this as a way to, have a political voice. And we've seen people be able to connect to each other. And this is especially important, I would say, in much of the global south and parts of the developing world. So I think that we do need to fix some things, but I'm worried that people will make this an opportunity to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm. So along those lines, there was a piece published in The Guardian yesterday by Barry Lynn and Matt Stoller, which puts forth a 9-point roadmap for the FTC of things that these authors think would help matters, that I'm sure as Facebook reads through this are sufficiently daunting and incentivizing of hopefully finding a roadmap that gets them out of this kind of approach, because they are not holding anything back here. They want the FTC to impose strict new privacy rules on Facebook, perhaps using the GDPR regulation as a guide. They want the spinning off of Facebook's ad network, eliminating in one swoop most of the incentive that Facebook now has to amass data and interfere and discriminate in the provision of information and news. They want to reverse the approvals for Facebook purchases of WhatsApp and Instagram and reestablish these as competing social networks. They want to prohibit all future acquisitions by Facebook for at least 5 years. They want to establish a system to ensure the transparency of all political communications on Facebook, similar to other major communications networks in the United States. They want to require Facebook to adopt open and transparent standards, similar to the conditions the FTC imposed on AOL Messenger in the AOL Time Warner merger. They want to establish whether Facebook violated the 2011 consent decree, and if so, seek sanctions. They want the FTC to threaten to bring further legal action against Facebook unless top executives immediately agree to work with the FTC to restructure their corporation to ensure the safety and stability of our government and economy. And they want to establish whether top executives enabled, encouraged, or oversaw violations of that 2011 consent decree, and if so, pursue personal fines against them. So it actually sounds like these two could have gone on and done a 20-point plan, but these are the 9 they considered most important. It sounds to me, Tiffany, like you think some of these might be going too far. Am I guessing that correctly?
You are definitely correct there. I actually just started laughing out loud when I was reading this because a lot of this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like this prohibit all future acquisitions by Facebook for at least 5 years. I mean, how does that at all address the issue of, third-party access to data, right? Like this is not a solution that actually solves the harms. Reverse the approval for Facebook purchase of WhatsApp and Instagram. Like these are not practical solutions. I understand some of their offers about the FTC enforcement and what to do about Facebook violating the consent decree. Those make sense, and those are somewhat reasonable. But I think it's ridiculous to go this far and say that we really just basically need to shut down Facebook and or silo them into a little corner for 5 years, and that'll solve all global privacy problems. This is not practicable.
All right. Well, how about the other night or afternoon here on the West Coast when Mark Zuckerberg did his apology tour and mentioned that he's amenable to not just testifying before Congress, if that's what Congress wants, but amenable to more regulation on the company, and was sort of, he didn't mention it by name, but was alluding to legislation that hasn't been passed but has been proposed about ad transparency. What do you think about that, him inviting more regulation, and what would he like it to look like?
I think it's interesting, right? Traditionally, these tech companies have not invited regulation, which is understandable. But I think at this point, they're aware that increased regulation is coming. And partially, I think, again, that's just because of the political pressures at play here. I think the Honest Ads Act is a fairly good proposal. It helps alleviate some of the issues that we've been talking about earlier, you know, in regards to political transparency. And the basic thing that it would do is create transparency around who is buying political advertisements on social media networks. So this would solve a lot of what Matt was just talking about as well. I think this would be a net benefit to most users, and also possibly to democracy generally. At the same time, it wouldn't be so impossible for these tech companies to implement. Like, they could actually do this in a practical manner. So this is an example of a sort of legislation that I think is narrowly tailored and reasonable, as opposed to some proposed bills that are a little overbroad and would have negative implications that don't actually solve the problems that they're trying to address.
Okay, Matt, what does your crystal ball say?
My crystal ball says that looking at the incentives of Mark Zuckerberg and saying that this is probably just building another moat around his business, that it's another technical development that anybody wanting to compete is going to have to build around. So probably the more complicated the system, the better for him. And two, I don't think it actually solves the problem, because I can open a pack tomorrow and call it whatever I want, and you can't have access to who owns the pack and or what political campaign it's technically aligned with. So, like, saying that it's transparent is just going to tell you whatever company I wanted to name my company. So I don't think it gets you anywhere. And also, like, I think we know who's, you know, whether who's funding them, but we certainly know whose side the advertisements are on. We know that if there's something bad about Hillary Clinton, it's probably funded by the other side. And if there's something, you know, bad about Donald Trump, it's probably funded by the other side. Like, I think that, you know, the pack is a wrinkle that this doesn't, it wouldn't allow it to be solvable, because most money that we're actually worried about isn't, you know, Denise or I or you know, normal people. Sorry to lump you in there, Denise. But like about us funding, you know, our favorite campaign for somebody. If I give all of the money I have, no one's going to care. You're really worried about like large corporate interest, and that's what this is about. And they can hide who it is, so it's kind of pointless.
Okay, so you're kind of throwing up your hands, it sounds like. I think if I gaze into my crystal ball, I kind of come down the same way, that I don't feel like this is going to have a huge impact. If I frame it in terms of my Santa's wish list, I think it's an opportunity for huge changes. I think it's an opportunity for lawmakers to pass smart legislation that incentivizes Facebook to shift its priorities, to honor user expectations, to be very transparent with not just how the data is used, but how users control the data and put them in the driver's seat. I said yesterday, I went on G3 with Tina Gilmore and some others, that one thing I'd love to see happen is for Facebook, in response to this, to say, hey, you know all those stories you've been seeing on locking down your Facebook page? We're just going to do that for you. We're going to make that the default. We're going to make your pages as private as they can possibly be. Your data as locked down as it can possibly be. And to the extent you want to grant anybody permissions, we'll let you do that on a case-by-case basis, and we'll give you meaningful information about what decision you're about to make, and you can make that decision. I don't think that's going to happen, but it certainly would be a great step. So maybe there is a way to incentivize moves in that direction. Maybe inviting legislation where Facebook has to put those kinds of priorities first will enable them to go to their ad networks clients and say, look, you know, we used to do things the way that you would prefer. We used to be able to give you all this data in a regular, unfettered way. We can't do that anymore. And we can quote you the new laws that explain why we can't. So they actually have something to point to say, hey, we're not doing it to you. We have to. So, you know, maybe we'll see some moves in that direction. I hope so. But realistically, watching the history of the company and its handling and the aftermath of former privacy debacles, I don't know. I don't know that we see a whole lot of change out of this. I want to be hopeful, but I'm not that hopeful. What do you think, Tiffany?
I think it's a good opportunity. I agree with you on that. I don't know if I really hope for the same kinds of things that you're hoping for. So
okay,
my Santa's wish list would be a little different.
All right.
Mostly because I don't know if we might be past the point where we can try to lock down privacy in the way that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Facebook is forced to make, you know, private settings the default, that doesn't mean anything for Twitter or Google or Amazon or any of those other companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we have a new legislation that enforces this broadly, it will have to be either very complicated and talk about many different use cases of data, or it will end up being overbroad, which would then probably be over limiting to the sort of tech services that we enjoy. Like, for example, I mean, not everyone agrees, but I like using some tech. I like having Amazon Echo. I like having, you know, Facebook and Instagram. I don't enjoy some things about these services, but I think that they're generally useful. And in terms of, you know, our economic power as a country, I think the tech industry is generally useful as well. So I'm a little concerned about negative consequences if we start, you know, broadly regulating without really thinking of the impact or the, you know, the impact both on consumers and on the industry. I also want to bring up just one point that I think a lot of issues with what I keep going back to, which is this question of overbroad regulation. This comes from my background working in the past for the Wikimedia Foundation, which is the nonprofit that runs Wikipedia. So this is not the opinion of the foundation, but I always think about companies or organizations that aren't Facebook or Google. So I think about Wikipedia and other nonprofits and other open source projects. I think about, for example, Medium, the blog website, which is a medium-sized company.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see new laws coming that could create these burdens that Facebook could easily handle. But if we do have that occur, we'll have to make sure that we protect, you know, the mediums and the Wikipedias. So that's something that I'd be really concerned about. Though it's possible we could find some happy medium. Now I just can't stop saying the word medium.
No, no, you can't.
Good, good.
Hey, you hit on something this week, Tiffany, that I thought was, you know, maybe again, looking for the silver lining in all of this. Maybe this is the way forward. You notice that Twitter's chief information security officer is leaving the company, that Facebook's has. Can we hold out any hope that these people are disgusted and see the opportunity here and want to get together and form the alternative approach that addresses all of our concerns? What do you think?
That would be amazing. I think this is a great opportunity for a new startup to come on the scene. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be hard for them to compete because, you know, they don't have all the millions of users that Facebook and the other services have, or the billions of users. But if there is a new competitor that can somehow protect your privacy, but offer services that people actually, you know, want to see, this is probably the best time for them to get on the scene. So if you or anyone listening has a startup like that, please make that public. Please make that a thing right now.
Yes. Opportunity never better. Matt, would you put all your data into such an enterprise?
Probably not. So I went through a trial run with a search engine that didn't store any of my data, and I hated it. I like that they are telling me what I want to know. So there's so many there's so many valuable things about having someone track you. So I like to think I care about privacy, but in my actual purchasing habits, I don't tend to actually show that. So a good hypocrite that I am.
Well, maybe the shift doesn't have to be as monumental as what we're talking about, although I'm still holding out hope for the chief information security officers to save us all. But Mike Elgin put out earlier this week that maybe this is when Google Plus finds its moment or refines its moment.
Maybe a bridge too far.
Maybe. I mean, but, you know, Google,
I'm just kidding.
Google targets ads to your searches and activity, but doesn't, you know, wholesale sell your data the way that Facebook does. So maybe there is a degree of trust that people might have. I don't know that the average consumer would get that distinction. The average consumer would probably think Google knows everything about me and I have no control over what they do with my information. And once again, maybe they're a data fiduciary I can trust, but maybe not. They're a private company. So nobody thinks Google Plus is coming back after this.
I haven't looked at it in a while. I don't think so. And they even have a good UI, but I don't know why. It just, I've never, you know, I'm not the greatest social user anyways. But the one thing that I think that would be good coming out of this is private suits. As a good, you know, burgeoning wannabe attorney, I think that money damages are the best option here, because when I start companies that we're collecting your data, one of the first things you want to do is get insurance for that data. And the insurance protocols are for those medium-sized companies, in what they're really looking at, they don't have the large money to be able to deal with data breaches and all of this. And so you have to work on doing best practices so you can lower your insurance rate. So, you know, if suits are out there for private breaches and these sort of things, and that's a threat, then the private market with insurance tends to create better practices, at least. Maybe not best practices. Maybe not the best world we want to live in. But this is a good reason why, us pesky lawyers suing people is sometimes a good thing.
Yep, and the pesky lawyers have been busy over the Facebook events of the last week. There were, this morning, I'm sure the counter is still ticking along, but as of this morning, 4 lawsuits pending, 2 of them shareholder derivative suits related to the precipitous plunge in stock price based on Facebook's non-disclosures of key information related that could impact the stock price, and 2 by users impacted by the sharing of their information. And I'm sure that won't be the end of the suits that we see there. Of course, suits like that tend to have a greater impact on the medium-sized companies that Tiffany was referring to than on a behemoth like Facebook. But you're right, Matt. Even Facebook has to buy insurance, so they want to control their rates. Before we get into our concluding material of the week, let's take a cruise on over to the realm of legislation, regulation, and policy and just observe that SESTA and FOSTA was passed this week. Uh, So this, we've discussed this on the show before. It has been discussed much in Congress and in the Senate. When it came right down to it, Congress passed its version of the bill some time ago. The Senate this week had its vote. Only two senators voted against passing SESTA and FOSTA, which is an anti-sex trafficking bill that alters the function and wording of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. One of the authors of that act, Ron Wyden out of Oregon, was one of the senators who voted against the bill that passed, also Rand Paul. Other than that, it was 97-2 to pass the bill. So it did pass. People are very concerned that the medium companies are going to suffer big time, the medium and small companies, under the new regime, because they're going to have to make choices that protect them from any kind of their users' activity, which could be construed as sex trafficking. The bill is pretty broad, and the choices that companies are left with are not great. I mean, they have to either take a completely hands-off approach and say, we're not paying attention, so we can't be held accountable, or to the extent they actually want to have, you know, a civilized site with rules and guidelines and moderation, they're on a slippery slope as to whether they're taking enough steps to curb this kind of activity. So as Mike Godwin, I believe, has written, a would-be Facebook killer, yes, this is from Mike Godwin's piece at Slate, a would-be Facebook killer wouldn't be able to compete by building a better Facebook. The poor chief information security officers, because the best it could aim for is to be a better Prodigy. Prodigy, the original walled garden of online services, was an early competitor among online companies with its forums highly moderated by its staff. You couldn't post your content publicly on the service without subjecting your postings to screening by Prodigy editors. Unsurprisingly, Prodigy in its original form didn't do well in the long run, competing initially with the more open, less moderated services like AOL and CompuServe, or ultimately with the offerings of the wide open internet itself. So any thoughts, Tiffany, on the passage of SESTA and FOSTA?
This was not a surprise. Mm-hmm. I think that internet advocates have been upset about this bill for a while, but we knew it was going to be passed. The tides were turning against us, or that community, for quite a while. Personally, I was not a huge fan of SESTA, FOSTA. For similar reasons as what Mike Godwin pointed out. Mm-hmm. The burdens that this, again, overbroad piece of legislation put on websites disproportionately harm websites that are smaller. So again, the medium-sized companies suffer a lot here. And I think that the nonprofits or companies or organizations that don't have the same sort of data or information, but still might have to fall under the purview of this law, they will also suffer in ways that the law doesn't really think about. And generally, there's also an interesting argument that some people have made that this anti-sex trafficking bill actually harms sex workers, because now all of their activity will have to be taken off of these more or less legitimate websites and put back, say, you know, colloquially back into the street alleys, right? Mm-hmm. So this could actually harm the people that it's trying to protect. And that doesn't seem like a great piece of legislation to me if you're not solving the problems and actually hurting the people you're trying to protect.
Yes, I'm skeptical about it doing good as well. Matt, anything you want to add here?
Yeah, I just think that this is a really interesting study in legislative intent, because mm-hmm. this is a case where, on its face, if this came for judicial review, you'd say 98-2, the legislature knew exactly what they were doing. They put in this law, like, no questions asked on, like, the interpretation or the intent, or, like, this is as close to, like, perfect, this is the will of the state as anything you get to, and yet, just because the incentives are – misaligned in that who really, other than like the crazy libertarian Rand Paul and someone who thought a lot about the issue, is going to come out against a sex trafficking, criminal statute. Like, yeah. and it just seems, it just kind of a little bit frustrating, just because like you wish your legislature would like read into and think through the implications. But it's really just something that like, how do they explain to their constituents that I voted for sex trafficking? Whatever the actual logical conclusion is, that's what they're thinking. So it is a, no system is perfect. And, we certainly don't have a perfect political process or anything like that. But this is like an example of a major flaw that, on these hot button issues, we don't necessarily think through them, even when, vote tally thinks that we really like vote tally. We think we have like a perfect, nearly perfect law right here. My opinion is not, but.
Right. Yeah. That's a really good point, that just the optics of this bill, I think trumped its function. So, we will make our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, 97-2, in its honor. And with that, let's move on to something a little bit more uplifting, our animal selfie of the week. I'm kind of excited about this one. We've had a lot of birds, but I don't believe we've ever before had penguins. And these are some good penguin selfies. Let's go ahead and take a look at them. They got a hold of a camera and made great use of it. There we go. Hello, penguins. Now, I don't believe this was a trap camera. I think this is one that was dropped or left by a photographer in hope of getting great footage like this. And lo
sort
and
of, sort of related, but yes. I think that wasn't there some story recently about like we just found in like part of Antarctica that there was like millions of penguins that we just didn't know about before. I wish I had a link to it, but I think something that's so cool that we just didn't know that there was millions of penguins somewhere, with all the cool technology we have, that we lost like millions of these awesome birds. That makes me so happy.
It does make me happy. Maybe there's hope for other species of animals that we have no idea. It's Sasquatch.
If we could never find them, it'd probably be better. Yes.
The Yeti lives.
Yeah.
Let's see. Our tip of the week comes from the title of a review of the Science Channel's series on Silicon Valley, which is called How Not to Tell the Story of Silicon Valley. So I suppose that is our tip, how not to do it. The Science Channel has a series called Silicon Valley, The Untold Story, a docuseries comprising several hours of history of the technology industry specific to Silicon Valley. The author of this review, Amy Glynn, was not real happy about the way, specifically her complaint was just that they didn't do a very deep dive and that it is sort of a hot tub time machine nightmare. And I have to agree with her on both points. There's you could do, a 30-hour docuseries on this and still have interesting stories to tell, but the way they jump around in time is a bit jarring too. Yet, I'm going to recommend the series. There's some great old footage of Silicon Valley, and the stories that are told actually, I think, are they really put into perspective the things that we talk about here each week, and they really emphasize the Silicon Valley's ability to break things apart and reassemble in a new way and move forward in ways that weren't foreseen before. So it's overarching theme, I think, is a valuable one. And I have enjoyed watching the series, but agree with Amy Glynn that it leaves a little few things to be desired. Have either of you seen this yet?
I haven't.
I have not.
Nope. Okay. I think it's worthwhile. Our resources of the week. I'm going to start out with something we've been using during the show that I think is really cool, and it comes via listener Jonathan Annette. Annette. I always get myself confused on that one. But it is called ThreadReader Bot, and it is a bot on Twitter that will take multi-threaded tweets and put them together. All you have to do is reply to any tweet of a thread and mention @ThreadReaderApp with the word unroll. And it gives you a link back. And what it does is create a separate page with all the links packaged together like a blog post, basically, or a Medium post. So it just makes working with threaded tweets far nicer. And the tweet that Jonathan gave me as an example of how this worked has to do with a woman who is a game developer. Her name is Jessica Price. She is @Delafina777 on Twitter. And she had a lengthy thread of tweets describing some male coworkers of hers that called someone on a sexist thing that had happened in front of them. And rather than coming to all their female coworkers and saying, "Oh, I saw this and it made me so appalled," they actually went to the perpetrator and said, "Hey, you can't do that." And this Jessica Price was quite pleased with that and did a laudatory thread of tweets about it. So I encourage you to check that out. Our medium final resource of the week is one of Tiffany's tweets from early on in the week that got, let's see, you're clocking 50,471 likes on this one, Tiffany, so far, and close to 14,000 retweets. That's impressive. And what she says briefly and breezily is, "Here's what people really want from tech: Instagram, chronological timeline; Spotify, let us block artists; Amazon, don't create an inescapable surveillance panopticon; Facebook, don't end democracy; and Snap, more filters." So you must be gratified by all the traction that got, and also the fact that you seem to have made a difference with Instagram. Did you see?
Well, I mean, people have been complaining for years, but sure, I will take all the credit for this.
That's what I would do, for
yes,
sure.
I think it is due. Credit where credit is due, Tiffany. Thank you for changing Instagram. They implemented something this week. I haven't even checked it out yet, but apparently things
you
are more.
Google Plus, though.
Huh?
You missed Google Plus, though.
That's right, you did. Oh. What do people want from Google Plus?
Yeah. I don't know if anyone wants anything from Google Plus at this point.
Sad. All right. And then our final resource of the week, very much in keeping with what we've been discussing about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and privacy considerations in general, is a TED Talk by, gosh, I'm going to butcher her name, Zeynep Tufekci, maybe? Zeynep Tufekci. Her talk is called "We're Building a Dystopia Just to Make People Click on Ads." It's a really good TED Talk. It's about 23 minutes long. I encourage you to check it out. It very much illustrates how people's data is used and may open your eyes to some of those things or make you just facepalm about things you already knew. But it's very interesting. And I also thought, I stumbled on this on Facebook, and I thought it was kind of hilarious and ironic that when I clicked through the Facebook link to put a, you know, to derive a link that I could put in our rundown and share with our panel today, it immediately appended on after the question mark, as these services do, all the metadata that tells you that this came from a social campaign and the source was Facebook, and what the content of the source was, and, you know, so all the metadata that someone could use for whatever targeting purposes they wanted came through with the link to this particular talk, which I think, just sort of sums up the state of affairs that we're living in today. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It has been so great chatting with you again, Tiffany. Thank you so much for all the great writing and thought that you have done on privacy issues in general, particularly on this Facebook story this week.
Great. It's always fun to be on the show. Thanks for inviting me again.
Wonderful to see you. Is there anything you want to let us know about before we sign off today, whether with yourself personally or your practice or with the Yale Information Society Project?
Sure. So I can take this time to plug the Yale Information Society Project. We are an interdisciplinary research center that's based in Yale Law School, and we have scholars studying issues like tech platform governance, like privacy, like cybersecurity, copyright law, all of those fun things that we talk about on this show, or that you talk about on this show every week. So if you're interested, check out our website. It's on the screen right now. And we have a number of publications and also some events that we occasionally live stream and or record. It's a great place to do research, and it's a fun website to check out if you want to read even more about all of these issues.
And you're still involved with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry as well?
I am. I am a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, and I'm also a fellow with the Transatlantic Digital Debates Program, which is an interesting program that is a collaboration between tech policy professionals in Germany and in the U.S. So we look at a lot of these issues from a transatlantic perspective, which I'm sure you all know is very different. The European perspective on privacy and on free speech is just slightly different than the perspective we have in the U.S. So lots of fun studying these issues from all these different angles.
Very cool. Keep up the great work, and thank you so much again for joining us today.
Great. Thanks.
Matt Curtis, wonderful to see you again. How's everything going at Notre Dame these days?
Things are crazy. I just blew through my spring break, and I wish I had another. if someone can find one of those along with the Penguins, I'd be really excited.
We'll try.
It was great to have Tiffany on, and one day maybe I'll get 55 people to retweet mine rather than 55,000. But I think it's, the work you're doing is really cool, and it's just amazing how much you write and how well that is. And I think it speaks to your diligence in this and your thoughtfulness in working through these topics. So appreciate having you on.
Thank you. I appreciate that a lot.
And we appreciate all of you joining us for this episode of This Week in Law. If you've joined us on a Friday starting at 11 o'clock Pacific time or 1800 UTC, that means you've joined us live. Yay, you've got to see us record the show. That's always fun. We love it when people join us live. That means they can jump into IRC and let us know their thoughts as well at irc.twit.tv as we're doing the show. But if that time frame doesn't work for you, don't worry about it. You can head on over to twit.tv/twill. And our shows get posted there after we record them, and they live on there in perpetuity. So if you want to look back to our thoughts on the Facebook consent decree with the FTC in 2011, for example, I'm sure we talked about it way back then. The whole archive of shows is there to be consumed at your leisure. You can subscribe in any way, shape, or form that you like. There's some guides there for the various devices that you can watch the show on, be it your phone, your TV, what have you. However you join us, we're just thrilled that you do. Thank you so much for being part of our audience. Please do get in touch with us to let us know what you thought about this show, the topics we discussed, anything that's on your mind that you think we should discuss, people you think we should invite on the show. We love hearing from you, whatever is on your mind. People send me jokes. It's great. Email me at Denise at twit.tv. Matt is mattc@twit.tv. Mike is mike@twit.tv. So let us know between the shows what's on your mind there, or you can hit us up on Twitter or Facebook. If you haven't deleted Facebook yet, definitely we have a page over there where you can let us know what's coming across your feed that you think we should pay attention to, and you can see the stories that we're getting ready to discuss in upcoming shows. Our Flipboard magazine is great for that too. If you find me on Flipboard, I'm D Howell. I keep a This Week in Law magazine there that even if, you know, if you like Flipboard and you're a heavy user and you stumble across things that you think we should be paying attention to, you can become an editor of that This Week in Law magazine there along with me and our co-hosts and lots of our former guests, et cetera. Just shoot me an email and I'll add you to that. I should let you know that the Twit Flash Briefing is available in Canada and Australia and the United Kingdom. If you are an Echo user, also India, it's been in the US for a while. So if you haven't done it yet, go into your Alexa app and add us as part of your Flash Briefing. I always enjoy listening to the Twit Flash Briefing along with many of the other great offerings in there. It's part of my morning routine these days and really enjoy that. And with that, we'll go ahead and sign off. Thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Law. Until next time, take care.